Dr. Pickering.
Yeah.
This is Bob Ward with the Huntsville Times.
Oh, yes.
It's an honor to speak with you. I don't think we ever met. I know I'd remember it if I did. I have been a reporter and editor with the Huntsville Times since 1957, and have done quite a bit of writing in the space field, not just for the paper, but a few books and articles in magazines and what have you, and have not been a space reporter, quote unquote, for a long, long time. But anyway, I was here during Dr. Von Braun's era, of course, and am quite close to Ernst Stuhlinger and Connie Dannenberg and some of those folks. What I'm about now, in 1972, a full 5 years before Dr. Von Braun's death, I wrote and had published in Germany in hardcovers a kind of a wit and wisdom of Werner von Braun. And I made some efforts to get it published in this country at that time, but did not succeed, and then got very busy with work and went on. And we are having in mid-1999 to mid-2000 a Werner von Braun celebration of the arts and sciences here to mark through various cultural and technical events in town milestones like the 50th anniversary of the von Braun teams coming and the, what would that be, 30th anniversary of Apollo 11. I chaired for the governor the 20th anniversary celebration. We had a space celebration here and had the Apollo 11 flight crew to the Space and Rocket Center and everything. So I kind of kept a hand in. Anyway, I'm getting encouraged by some friends and associates, including some Von Braun team members, to revive and revise and update this manuscript I have. The German publisher got Professor Oberth to do the foreword to my... Yes, he is. But as I said, this was 25 years ago, and I will be happy to, let me hasten to say, to send you some material so you can see my credentials or something. But what I am doing now is adding to this body of work I did 25 years ago with some anecdotes and both humorous and then other vignettes and what have you that give insight into the personality, the character, the philosophy of Dr. von Braun. Much of it is light material, humorous material, but not all. And frankly, and we'll have this published in this region, probably. I won't seek a national publisher in connection with that year-long celebration. So I know that you and Dr. von Braun have quite a close association with you at JPL, and if not beginning with Explorer 1, certainly including that early on, and catching a cold like this, you may choose to think about this for a day or two and have me write or call later. But I was wondering if you, frankly, had any two or three favorite anecdotes or stories that where Dr. von Braun figured in that, or you and he did.
Actually, if I think about von Braun, one of the
Cancer in 70 when he went to NASA headquarters, but Yes. You know, as
far as
yes, he sure did in the Anglican Church, right. He a little side light to that is that when he got the what he took to be a terminal diagnosis, he came back to the arsenal and went around recruiting pallbearers. And one of the men that he asked to serve as a pallbearer, and to shock General Medeiros out of this fatalism or defeatism or something, said, hell no, Bruce, I won't serve as your pallbearer. Just as soon as I did, walking with you, you'd raise up and say, man, you aren't doing it right, or something like that. And as you say, sure enough, he, I did hear that he, well, of course, he survived and lived well into his 90s. I did have the pleasure of knowing the Big Hill, as he was called around. He sure was. Let's see, does anything else come to mind now? Or perhaps should I ask you to think about it for a little while? And
well, I might think about it, but why don't you give me a call in a few days and see if I can put up anything else?
All right. Very good. And this is, it's best to reach out work here, right? And what's the name of your company? Did I hear Magnetics or?
Lignetics.
Oh.
Lignetics.
Lignetics.
We're in the business of making sawdust into fuel pellets.
Oh, is that right?
Do you know about these pellet stoves?
Oh, yes.
Okay, well, we're making pellets for them.
Yes, is that right?
Ha ha.
Hello.
Doctor.
I'm unable to answer your call just now. At this speed, please leave your name, telephone number, and a short message. I will get back to you as soon as I can. Ready?
Hello, I'm calling for Dr. Adolf Teal. My name is Bob Ward. I'm a longtime journalist with the Huntsville, Alabama Times. I'm doing some revising and updating a book I had published several years ago about Dr. Von Braun, sort of the human side of him, a wit and wisdom book. My numbers, telephone numbers, are at work at the Huntsville Times, 256-532-4439. Or at my home on in evenings and on weekends, 256-881-3553. Ernst Stillinger and Dr. Conrad, Dr. Stillinger and Conrad Dannenberg had referred me to you, and Dr. Dannenberg recently gave me your telephone number and address. I thought it might be good for me to talk with you briefly. I'll be glad to elaborate on my my book project later. Look forward to hearing from you. And,
hello.
Dr. Teal.
Yes.
That was quite a long message by me. Sorry.
Yes.
How are you?
I'm fine.
Good.
Hold on, please.
Yes.
Hello.
Yes, Dr. Taylor, are you doing well?
Yes.
Good. I don't know whether you heard me identify myself.
Yes.
I'm with the Huntsville Times, right. A former space reporter for the newspaper back in the 50s and 60s.
Yeah.
And have written a few space-related books over the years.
Okay.
I did for a German publisher in the early 1970s, a And it was never published in the U.S. or in English in any form. Professor Oberth did the foreword or introduction to the German language version. And Dr. Von Braun, back in about 1969, did an introduction to a book I had published in New York called A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Moon, some of the later true stories from the space program. Anyway, we are having in the Huntsville area a Wernher von Braun celebration of the arts and sciences that will run from summer of 99 to the summer of 2000. And that will mark the 50th anniversary of course, your team coming to Huntsville, and the 30th anniversary of Apollo 11, and some other milestones. I've been encouraged to dust off my old manuscript of this Wit and Wisdom book about Dr. Von Braun, and perhaps add some material. It was published 5 years before his death, so there's some material to add in those years, and I really want to do a good job with this, so I'm contacting a small number of both team members and others who knew Dr. Von Braun, and you know, including some of the American-born managers, associates. So, I was wondering if I might talk with you either now or later and see if there were any stories that came to mind, whether they've ever been told or not, that you think would be appropriate to this. I think you left Huntsville about 1954, 53? 55. 55, I see. 55. I beg your pardon?
Early 55.
Oh, in early 55.
Yeah.
And you joined
TRW.
TRW?
Yes.
I know you joined industry, right?
Yeah. Former SDL and North TRW.
Ah, I see. You know, my material, I'm going back even to the Kummersdorf and Peenemünde years, and Fort Bliss, of course, and I didn't know whether any little interesting vignette or whether it's an amusing story or something else that would shed light on Dr. Von Braun's personality and character and philosophy might occur to you. Oh, by the way, have you seen or heard of the Alabama Heritage magazine articles that were recently published?
No.
You are mentioned in that. This Alabama Heritage magazine is published by University of Alabama campuses, the Tuscaloosa and Birmingham, and it's quite a good historical magazine about Alabama. It's a good, slick, quality magazine. Anyway, a fellow named Mike Wright, who is the current Marshall Space Flight Center historian for NASA, has done this extensive two-part piece that ran in the spring edition and the summer edition. I would be happy to send you a copy.
I would very, very much like to have it.
Oh, good. It talks about a Dr. A.K. Teal at one point. Oh, let's see. Let me see. It says, not But unless, unless we make people understand what space travel is, and unless the man who pays the bills is behind us, nothing is going to happen. So, and there may be another reference to you in there. You must have told that story to someone someday. One day. Well, you know, I'm catching a cold here about events of many years ago. Why don't I send you these articles and a little background material on what I'm up to now? And by the way, I am getting the cooperation of everybody from Ruth von Sarma to Ernst Stillinger to Connie Dannenberg and you know, a bunch who are my friends. And I'll send you these articles and then call you in a week or two, perhaps.
Yes, please.
Would that be best?
In about 2 weeks.
All right, about 2 weeks. Good. And rather than leaving you my numbers, I'll just call you.
Good.
All right. Well,
thank
Dr.
you very much.
Dr. Teal, nice to talk with you. I'll call you back in a couple of weeks.
Yes.
Thank you.
Bye. Presentation was excellent.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I think that's all on the air. Yes, it is. But anything you can do to, you know, that's mainly a few short stories, anecdotes, vignettes of that relate to von Braun. When did you first meet him, or and it was it when you came here, or you had known him earlier?
I was the CEO of the Detroit Ordnance District.
I see.
At the onset of interest in the Redstone program.
When was that?
Now let me see. That was in. I got back here from Vietnam, and then went to Redstone, so, and I was 5 years at the War College, Army War College, and before that, I was a CO, so let's see, what is that, that's the early 50s, I guess.
I got you.
I came here in 1963, direct from Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
I might add, parenthetically here, that I made a career out of avoiding assignments to Redstone, mostly because during my Detroit years, I had occasion to visit Redstone, and all I could see was a lot of red mud, and it looked to me like an almost impossible situation.
Sure.
But when I was on way back from Redstone, from Vietnam, my orders were changed without my having anything to do about it. Since that was about a 35-hour trip by air, they could do lots with it. John Zier was responsible for my coming here, Chief of Staff.
Oh, is that? I see.
That's the way it happened. But in the Detroit late 50s, the Department of Defense, I believe it was, issued a $350 million contract through Redstone to Chrysler to start the Redstone missile program. Which was designed mind the as the vehicle, the carrier for a nuclear weapon, and it was then that von Braun was considered by many as something of a freak, you know, with this space business.
Sure.
But he was resolute, believe me. And I did all I could. I was captivated by his enthusiasm.
Mm-hmm.
And I got into it, and I thought, well, why not? It's going to be the wave of the future.
Sure.
So I did all I could to help Werner in his campaign, and that involved some problems with the Department of Defense officials with whom I did business. I see, I actually administered that program because it was in my district, it was strictly geographic.
Oh, I see.
And I think the key moment in my contact with him was a telephone call from him asking if some arrangements could be made for him to deliver his lecture. And it just happened that the Deputy Director of Defense, Roger Keyes,
mm-hmm.
I think that's K-E-Y-E-S, as I recall, and he was, Charlie Wilson was the
Secretary of
Defense at that time, and Roger Keyes used to come back to Detroit frequently, I might say, at least allegedly official business, but he had strong roots in Detroit.
Mm-hmm.
See, he was the president of Yellow Coach, which was the predecessor of the GMC truck division.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
No.
And he was also known and widely reputed as a hatchet man for Charlie Wilson. And he always would make his lend some credence to his trips to Detroit. He'd drop in on me and look around a bit and then go off, which I considered it to be kind of an onerous thing. And no one likes to have a high-ranking official drop in on his operation because he can always find something wrong. But
sure.
So I called Roger Keyes and told him that we had a visitor coming in connection with the Redstone program, and thought perhaps he'd like to get a comprehensive briefing from the man who was behind it all, one Werner von Braun. And he allowed us how he could probably spare an hour or so for
mm-hmm.
this. And I shot back to von Braun, told him to come ahead and bring his stuff with him. We'd furnish the recording equipment and all that. And he came in, I'll never forget it. He apparently had this as a last minute thing. He just threw all this stuff into a suitcase and on he came with a couple of his aides.
Slides and what have you.
Right. Surprise.
Mm-hmm.
And he gave a very convincing demonstration to Roger Keyes. Very. So much so that Keyes was became a spaceman that day.
Mm-hmm.
And he overstayed his hour by a good bit.
And the presentation was on space?
On the Redstone mission program and the background for it.
As a forerunner to
that's right.
Space launch mission.
He was questioned by Roger Keyes at length. Little was known then by about proposing. Roger Keyes was intimately familiar, of course, with the piston-driven engine.
Mm-hmm.
The rocket engine was something else again. Von Braun did a very good job of that. But he came in, he was somewhat tousled and so forth, and he he did a wonderful job, and that's when I first met him, and when Dr. Dodge left, well, I helped him get ready to go come back to Redstone. And subsequent to that, I had some difficulties with the Navy over an unused plant, which had been built for the Korean effort to build engines for the these were jet engines. And much of the equipment was still in its original condition. The war has winding down now.
I see.
But the Navy was very reluctant to turn this equipment over to what they thought was a rather flaky operation.
Mm-hmm.
And they weren't alone. Many did felt that way about it. So I didn't know what to do. I turned to Roger Kies. He'd been down there and he knew what the score was. And I talked to him on the phone. He said, well, he said, I think we can have help there. And we got the plan. We had built rocket engines there, Chrysler did. But because rocket engines were built, if I'm not taken at that time by North American Rockwell, if you might call it. But that's how I got to know von Braun. And thereafter, our contact was quite frequent.
Right. And that would have been in the 50s. In the late 50s when you met it.
Well, let's say mid-50s would
right.
be the best way. I should have kept a diary and all this. It's kind of historic stuff in a way.
Sure.
But he was a man with a driving force. It was very evident.
Mm-hmm.
Everything was there. Then, of course, came the Man and the Moon in this decade.
Right.
That was the schedule that he had, and he was going to make it come hell or high water. And his every effort after that toward his crew, there now stationed at Redstone in a going operation, was dedicated to that. We have a commitment to put a man on the moon in this decade, and we are going to meet it. And of course few believed that. And but the work went on. He convinced Medaris, who at that time was head of the Ballistic Missile Agency unit.
Oh yes.
Right. And he convinced him of his the viability of this program. But then this, of course, was a very forceful jet. You knew him.
Oh, yes. He was indeed.
I knew him a long time, of course, being in the service, and I worked under him. He was head of the ammunition division, so we were not strangers. But he drove that organization hard. And you know, here I'd like to get in a little word about one of the most remarkable things about von Braun and his crew, mostly von Braun, is picture the technical capabilities of an extremely rural area. Very low on the order, I think.
Sure.
One of the remarkable things about von Braun was taking training programs, devising a training program to train people who had small farms in the area, rode around in pickup trucks for the and made of them a very competent, highly qualified technical
Mm-hmm. Including the prototype manufacturer.
That is exactly right. Yeah, they were working in dimensions that are almost unbelievable. A millionth of an inch here or there was quite important.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, he was the driving force behind the establishment of the technical center out of Bridgestone Arsenal.
Right.
Which later became, of course, UAH. And he had his people out there training it was clear to him that the space program was going anywhere, there needed to be one hell of a lot of education. And he never missed the opportunity to address teacher organizations.
Mm-hmm.
And I did a lot of work driving around with him to these things. As a matter of fact, I wrote several speeches for him. He accepted them. Therein lies a little story, too, that's of interest. He had the legislature, the Alabama legislature, in his pocket.
Is that right?
By the force of his projected personality and driving force that I mentioned before.
You see, he addressed them at least twice and got millions in bond issues out of it.
Yeah, he did. He got them to go along. Yeah. And I remember one time, specifically, on a trip to Montgomery, we went down in the Redstone Arsenal's beechcraft, Queen Air.
Mm-hmm.
And he piloted. He was an excellent pilot.
That's what I understand.
He could do any, he'd fly jets or whatever. And we go down there, and he had this, I gave him the cards. He wanted his speech on the cards. He took the cards when he got in the plane. He got the plane in the air and going along rather well. And he would put the cards on the column and go through it while we were flying.
Oh, is that right?
And every time he underlined the important points. And every time he underlined a point, why the plane went this way. And then he'd bring it back up. We went to Montgomery. He got there and he did his customary job again, which reinforced, of course, the legislature's enthusiasm for this program, which made them a pretty far-sighted legislative body compared to some of the country group. And it was on one of those one trip that he, when we drove it, he was a wild driver. He didn't know the meaning of a stop sign. But he outlined to me something that I think was highly significant. Showed how he was thinking was going on. He envisaged a plan whereby there would be an island established in the Atlantic. And that island would be the generating plant through nuclear power for the extraction of hydrogen from seawater.
Hmm.
He was great on the subject of the use of hydrogen, naturally.
Mm-hmm.
Because hydrogen is a wonderful source of energy.
Mm-hmm.
It's also a dangerous source of energy, but it is abundant, it's unlimited.
Mm-hmm.
And he would extract that, and he would ultimately pay for the process by the extraction in the process of metals from the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
And this includes gold.
Huh.
And as far as the distribution system was concerned, you think we already have a distribution system intact. It's going to need modification, but it's there. The natural gas. We would pipe, he said, the gas from our generating plant in the Atlantic, he said, to some designated landfall, where it would be then routed to all parts of the United States. And we would have the source of energy we want, which would pay for itself, which would be clean, nothing but bother the environment about,
mm-hmm.
and would be dedicated toward creating all the energy that this country needed. And he said, I have drawn up some figures to back my thinking on that. I didn't ask him for them. I wish I had. It would've been interesting.
Mm-hmm.
But no, of course, that was fraught with all kinds of technical difficulties, because hydrogen going through a conduit pipe, you know,
will
ease out and perhaps some form pockets plate.
Mm-hmm.
If this pipe were made, for instance, of an iron alloy, steel, hydrogen is notorious for what it does to steel. It hydrogenizes it, which makes nitrides.
Mm-hmm.
Brittle.
Explosive.
Yeah, he says all that can be handled. He says
mm-hmm.
what we're having along, what we're distributing now is also explosive.
Mm. What a far-seeing
he thought of that
idea that was.
And he said, yeah, this could be done. He had the idea that there was nothing that a human being can't do if he was sufficiently motivated and driven to it.
Mm-hmm.
And this was, of course, at the root of his work in Pena Mundi, which he insisted to me and to others, that the sole purpose of his work in Pena Mundi was, he said, as furtherance of the goal to put a man on the moon. Even then,
mm-hmm.
at that time,
mm-hmm.
and he kept that up. And, that's why he surrendered to the Americans, because he said, and this I'm quoting one of the Germans out, he said, fellas, there's only one country in the world that can provide the resources and technical capability that we need to fulfill our ultimate project, and that's the United States. Let's go. And off he went. So, He was just that motivated.
And again, certainly visionary and
absolutely.
And analyzed the situation pretty clearly there.
Yeah. And you know, Bob, there wasn't a single flight of a space, what you might call a test vehicle, be it the Redstone, or be it subsequent stages of the Saturn. Not one of them. And they were all unmanned. He wouldn't put anything in the air that had any chance, in his opinion, of resulting in a loss of life.
Uh-huh.
And we can, and mind you, he wasn't around when they had that disastrous fire in the Saturn, where the three astronauts were
on the path. was Johnson Space Center's doing.
Precise.
With the spacecraft.
With the,
right.
The reason subsequently, well, not only before that, but they were North American Rockwell. He had all of these things loaded with sensors. So anything that happened, they could read every aspect of it and correct it. They devoted their time and attention to that. And we had a contract with North American Rockwell to build the S2 stage, which was a new type stage because its engines were liquid hydrogen and oxygen.
And liquid oxygen, right.
The Saturn first stage was used the kerosene and liquid oxygen. But liquid hydrogen was, of course, quite a bit colder than liquid oxygen. So these five big engines of the first stage, which incidentally was the most powerful engine ever built by man that was controllable. So,
was that the F1 in the S1 stage or whatever?
The S2 stage
was
the first one that had the hydrogen.
Yes, right.
And building that stage, of course, was quite intricate.
Mm-hmm.
And we had all kinds of problems with the contractor.
Mm-hmm.
And it got to be, he sent Sam Yarkin, I recall it well, was the program manager for the S2 stage. And he had all kinds of trouble with the people at North American.
Mm-hmm.
North American was used essentially the Air Force technique. You give a guy a program, you specify what you want, you incorporate it in a contract, and you sit back and expect them to produce it. Well, Brown didn't buy that, nor did Reese, who was his chief engineer.
Mm-hmm.
Because, and with good reason, as it subsequently turned out. The president of North American Rockwell was the space division. It was a chap named Storms, Harrison Storms. Harrison B. Storms was a well-known, highly successful aeronautics engineer. What else would you go to get to our stage of technology then?
Sure.
He also had some personal characteristics which tended to keep outside influence out of his plan.
Mm-hmm.
Well, von Braun got the backing of, I think, George Lowe was the administrator, and stated that this system was compromising the program's schedule, that we wouldn't make it if something wasn't done.
Mm-hmm.
And George Lowe authorized von Braun to put together a team to go out to the West Coast. And I was on that team, but Reese was ahead of it.
Mm-hmm.
No, Sam Yarkin was head of it, but I was Reese's representative.
I see.
And we went out to very unwelcome, both by the contractor and by the resident Johnson Space Flight Center group, which was there, which was bluntly not up to the task of contending with Harrison B. Storms, known as Stormy, well named.
Right.
So,
and what was their responsibility was which stage?
Second stage.
Oh, okay, the S2 stage. Right.
First stage that I think in which the liquid fueled, cryogenic fuel for you.
All right, I see.
So we went out there and I started in looking things over and found some rather substantial difficulties with their people and their objections. They did everything impossible to make it difficult for them.
Mm-hmm.
And one day, of course, when Brown transmitted all this back to Washington, his group was having trouble. And I wish I could be sure of this, but George Lowell, I think, was the administrator there. And we had a meeting out at North America, and it was to be a briefing by the North American people, including Storm. And it was at that meeting, the conclusion of it, rather, that when Brown just got up and addressed the crowd and said it to continue to interference of the president of North American space effort was impossible if this program was to continue.
Mm-hmm.
And he right then and there called for the resignation of Storm.
Is that right?
That was a monumental thing. It hasn't gotten out very much for good reason.
Mm. And this, the site of this talk was where?
In North America.
It was at their plant.
At their plant.
And he got up, this was at the conclusion
at the end
of this.
Yes.
Right.
All this was written. And North America, he said that any further participation by this president was intolerable.
Good heavens.
And you know, George Lowell, the president of North American overall was there. Now I'm talking about the head of their space.
Sure, Harrison.
The president of the whole works was there. I forget his name. But there was a lot of gas